case this morning is Griffith versus Department of Correctional Services. Justice Friedenberg is recused in this matter. Judge Arterburn from the Court of Appeals will join the court for this case. With that, we shall proceed. Is it Mr. Litteren Kaufman?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may approach. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And you may proceed.
I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is David Litteren Kaufman. I'm with Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe, and I represent the appellants. This case is not a challenge to the legality of the death penalty in Nebraska. This case is about the right of Nebraska citizens to participate in what is essentially lawmaking by the administrative branch of their government. The appellants here are representatives of their communities. Reverend Griffith is a retired United Methodist minister who served in churches across Nebraska, and Senator Chambers is a member of the Nebraska legislature representing North Omaha's 11th district. Both appellants participated in the regulation-making process, and their participation was undermined by NDCS's violations of the APA.
How was it undermined?
It was undermined because the statutorily required materials that the APA requires be made available in advance of the public hearing were not made available to them, and so their testimony at the hearing could not be informed by those materials.
But what was missing in particular?
What was missing was interim drafts, working copies of the proposed regulation.
And what statute requires interim drafts or preliminary drafts?
84907 and also 84906.01. 84907 requires draft copies and working copies, and 84906.01 requires records of consultations with experts and also all other materials prepared by or for the agency.
So what information in particular are you claiming that would have made a difference?
Well, that's precisely the problem. Without discovery, we don't know what documents were prepared. We don't know what that information is. And so we can't say specifically what documents might be available and how they would have made a difference. But it can't be the case that NDCS can get the benefit of its own violation by hiding those documents. It can then prevent someone from challenging their failure to make those documents available.
Which collection of documents, to which collection do you refer? A collection at DCS prior to regulations, or a collection at Secretary of State's prior to adoption, or after under 84906.01?
So under...
What are the allegations?
Right. So we allege that the materials that were prepared by NDCS in the drafting process, so those mm-hmm. are the draft and working copies.
At what point in time? Prior to adoption?
Prior to adoption, yes,
okay.
Your Honor.
Therefore controlled by which statute?
Both 84907 and 84906.01. 84907 sets forth the materials that have to be made available expressly in advance of the public hearing.
And is the allegation that the appellants sought to see those documents prior to adoption under 807?
Appellant...
907.
Yes, it is. Reverend Griffith sought to obtain those
okay.
materials.
And is the allegation that he went to Secretary of State or DCS or both?
The allegation is that he went to DCS, but DCS is required to maintain the materials under 84906.01, and there's no time period specified in 84906.01, and so those materials have to
so
be made.
So could 90601 be read to be maintained for at least 4 years after the effective date? But you're saying before the effective date, DCS should have a full set? In addition to the Secretary of State, is that your argument?
Not necessarily a full set. Our argument is that because some of those materials, it's true, don't exist until the regulation right. making process is completed. But because there's no provision in 90601 that says when the materials first have to be made available, our position is that as those materials come into existence, they have to be made available.
That's how you read 90601. So that's what we're exploring.
Correct.
Because we're not under 907, a trip to the Secretary of State. Is that correct?
No, we are also still under 907 because
Is that the allegation? We went to the Secretary of State and so forth, or it's not the allegation?
Appellants don't allege that they went to the Secretary of State, but it is a reasonable inference that can be drawn from the allegations in the complaint that if the materials were made available at the Secretary of State's office, they also would have been available at NDCS.
How is that a reasonable inference?
Because NDCS provides the materials to the Secretary of State's office. So if NDCS doesn't have them to make them available, then the Secretary of State can't either.
What did they provide?
They provide the proposed draft of the regulation that was filed with the Secretary of State that was made available for public comment.
So are you seeking emails or medical research or investigation regarding different drug use? What information do you anticipate being in these materials?
So we're requesting interim drafts, first of all. So it seems very unlikely that NDCS simply sat down and wrote out the revisions in one sitting, and that was it. We suspect at least that there were various iterations, things were added, things were taken out, and 84907 and 84906.01 require those iterations be made available. Also, consultations with experts, both within and without NDCS, in which they advise on the contents of the proposed regulations. Those are primarily what we're seeking. But again, we don't know what's available, so it's hard to specify.
What's your best argument for standing?
Our best argument for standing is that appellants suffered an actual injury, in fact. They have a procedural right under the APA to obtain these materials, and they were denied that procedural right. 84911 confers standing when common law standing exists, and common law standing requires an actual injury in fact.
The language of 84911 refers to a regulation threatening or impairing the rights of the petitioner, correct?
That's the language of 84911, that's correct.
And that's from where we would draw the injury in fact requirement.
Yes, but 84911.2 says that the court shall declare invalid any regulation that was not promulgated in accordance with the procedural requirements of the APA. Someone has to be able to enforce that remedy.
Who's the universe of potential plaintiffs?
We believe that the universe of potential plaintiffs are the people who appeared at the public hearing, who attempted to participate in the regulation-making process, and who were therefore harmed by the procedural violation.
But 84911 doesn't speak in terms of a procedural violation. It speaks in terms of someone who's being impaired, whose legal rights are being threatened or impaired by the regulation itself. And there's no claim that Reverend Griffith or Senator Chambers legal rights are impaired by the protocol, is there?
Well, I think there is an argument that 84911.1 also applies to appellants here. That argument is that the language there is written in the disjunctive. So it says the rule or regulation or its threatened application. So rule or regulation must mean something different than threatened application.
So your argument is both addressed to the process without regard to the substance of the regulation, right? That a person should be able to see what's on deck. Is that right? That's a processing, regardless if the substance had to do with death penalty or the environment and so forth. That's right? Is that one of your arguments?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and the other one is now in response to Justice Papik's questions, right? The substance of it matters. That is, the content of it. Are you saying both?
We do, Your Honor, and that's in particular under the matter of great public concern exception, that this implicates a matter of great public concern.
Which one? The process or the substance or both?
Both. It's a combination of three factors. It's that it's an unauthorized exercise of delegated legislative authority. It's that it implicates the notice and hearing provisions of the APA, which are designed to facilitate citizen involvement.
So that would be your argument without regard to the substance. It could be with respect to the environment. It could be with respect to death penalty or a lot of other topics. Is that correct?
That is correct. But because this case implicates the death penalty, it also invokes the heightened standard of vigilance under State v. Moore, which in combination with those other two factors, we believe, makes this a matter of great public concern. I see that I'm down to 50 seconds, so I'd like to reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Mr. Post, good morning to you.
May it please the court. Appellants lack standing under Section 84911 because neither their rights nor privileges are impaired by the regulation. Appellants did not argue otherwise in the brief and really didn't argue otherwise today.
So you're jumping into the substance of the regulation rather than addressing the process by which that a regulation was adopted. Is that it?
I think either way they lack standing. I think subsection 1 of 84911 says who can sue. Subsection 2 says what about. And so they keep wanting to point to subsection 2 and list the various things you can bring a challenge over. But you have to fit within subsection 1.
So who's the universe of potential plaintiffs?
In this specific instance, it would be the inmates on death row.
Could the inmates on death, so the suit you're envisioning is the inmates on death row bringing a lawsuit saying these other people requested information and didn't get it, and therefore the regulation's invalid?
Let me simplify the hypothetical just a little bit. Say the department didn't have a public hearing. It just blew right through the APA, didn't follow it at all. I think the inmates on death row could bring a procedural challenge to the regulation under 84911 and say, you didn't follow procedure. We have standing first. You didn't follow procedure, so it should be invalidated.
And at that point?
Yes.
So they would not have needed to have received a notice from the Attorney General's office that we will soon seek a death warrant?
I don't think so.
Is that right? For standing, they don't need that. They don't need to be that right. Anybody on death row could say the process was imperfect.
I do think they could, because the way the statute's word says the threatened application. And at that point, there's at least, and I understand your question, meaning it's not technically threatened until there's been a request for a warrant, but
I don't mean to be lighthearted about
sure.
this, but inspecting at the Secretary of State's office is not realistic for an individual who's a death row inmate, correct?
Correct.
So they're not going to be able to inspect the bona fides of that file after adoption, realistically.
I think that's true, but okay. I think the distinction, though, is could someone who's impacted by a regulation bring a challenge about a procedural violation that they did not personally witness? I think the answer is yes. And so whether
that's... Because why? That's a good government proposition?
I think Section 84911-2 okay. says that. I think it says that you can bring a challenge related to an alleged procedural violation, but in order to do so, you have to be someone who is impaired or affected by the regulation.
Do you think that subsection 2 speaks to any particular kind of procedural violation? Do you think it contemplates notice and hearing type violations, or do you think it is broad enough to include a challenge that members of the public weren't able to review certain documents in advance of the hearing?
Well, it's difficult to narrow it when it says was adopted without compliance with the statutory procedures. And I'm not sure that I can narrow it any more than that text. That would seem to apply to any of the statutory procedures outlined in the APA. The legislature didn't, outside of the reference to the Negotiated Rulemaking Act, the legislature didn't narrow it. So yeah, I think it would apply to any of the procedures.
Have any of our cases limited it to notice and hearing requirements?
Not that I'm aware of.
Do you think the universe of potential plaintiffs is limited to death row inmates?
In this particular case, challenging this regulation.
In this particular regulation?
Yes. I'd have to reread the entire regulation again, but I don't believe there's any other impact on anyone
else. So you're saying the universe is defined by the substance. In other words, I was exploring this with opposing counsel, that there could be a procedural challenge or a substantive challenge. The substantive challenge would obviously affect a death row inmate. But could the procedural challenge be brought by someone who was not a death row inmate?
In this instance, no, I don't believe so.
That's an answer to a different question. I don't mean to limit it to these facts. If you were a citizen and you sought to examine the file and the, and you were turned away capriciously?
I don't believe so. I don't believe 84911 contemplates that, because again, you'd have to somehow show that the regulation, straight from the statute, the regulation or its threat, or the threat.
I'm talking about the process, the existence of the file to which citizens have access.
I don't believe under 84911 they'd be able to bring that challenge.
What about people who are being prosecuted for a capital offense but haven't yet been sentenced?
At that point, I think you could make the distinction that they're not, at that point, they're not subject to the regulation yet.
Threatened?
Well, it's a rather broad term, so I don't believe so, but I guess we can take that up
so
if it comes.
So you concede that capital convicts, people who have been sentenced to death, are within the scope, but people who are potentially subject under existing proceedings, whereby that is a realistic possibility, in other words, there's been a alleged event, there's been a information alleging aggravators, and the state is seeking to impose a death penalty, are those, you would exclude those folks from the class of potential plaintiffs?
I would. I think at that point it's too hypothetical at that point, even though it's, you know, it's some, I don't even want to estimate the likelihood that it might apply to them in the future, but I don't think that they could show that they would be threatened with its application until they know that they are actually subject to the death penalty.
Well, if the information alleges sufficient aggravators and identifies it's a death penalty case, you're saying that's not enough to alert them?
I don't know that we could just jump ahead and assume that that's going to be the result of the criminal.
Well, we're in a statutory area, so what does threatened mean?
I think at that point we'd have to look at the whatever the common understanding of plain language of threatened is, and so you're not being threatened. At that point, that individual would be, I guess, threatened with the death penalty, but not threatened with the process of carrying it out until after they have been sentenced and all that procedure plays out.
Thank you.
It seems too many steps removed at that point. So many things would be contingent before you would get there.
So you've been focusing on injury in fact standing, or common law standing, but your briefing asks the court to reconsider the holding in Project Extra Mile to the extent that it expanded taxpayer standing into the kind of the realm of 84-911. What's your argument there?
We do. So for a couple reasons. The statute doesn't say that it applies to any person, any citizen. As you saw in my brief, other states have deviated from the Model Act. Nebraska's APA is based on a Model Act. Other states have deviated to create or expand the statutory cause of action to include other people. Nebraska has not. The only instance that I was able to find in which Nebraska has ever done so was the Project Extra Mile case. And in that case, the court applied principles from general taxpayer standing, which is, at least in the situation of a declaratory judgment action based on an entirely different statute, to 84-911, which has this very defined list of, or defined terms on who it applies to. And so I do think Project Extra Mile went beyond what the statute allows as far as who has standing under, specifically 84-911. All the other summary in Project Extra Mile, of all the other case law, we're not trying to touch. It's that very specific part of the holding that you can bring a taxpayer standing action under 84-911 that I don't think is actually allowed by statute.
What is your view on the precedential effect, if any, that four-judge plurality opinion in Thompson versus Heineman is entitled to?
That's a difficult question. So if I remember correctly, the four-judge plurality believed that it was precedential on the standing question and not on the constitutional question, and the dissent, I don't believe, opined on that particular question. I think the Thompson case is difficult to take much out of as it relates to standing. There's a number of instances in that case where other cases are recapped as it relates to, or there's summaries of other cases as it relates to standing. and those cases...
In some cases, recharacterized.
I would agree with that. Some of those cases do not necessarily even use the words referenced that are then later used in the Thompson case. And so it is difficult for me to put a lot of weight on the four-judge plurality in Thompson at all. As you see in our brief, we did make an alternative argument, which is even if all of the above applies, we still don't think they have standing here, or the appellants have standing under Project Extra Mile. And we would ask, unless there's no more questions, ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
One question. If Thompson versus Heineman, if the four-judge plurality opinion is entitled to precedential effect, what's the argument for why there would not be great public concern standing under that case?
Sure. So as far as I'm aware, there's only two instances where this court has applied matters of great public concern exception, or at least tried to. One was Cunningham. The second one was Thompson. Both at least used, they challenged a constitutional issue, which isn't present here. And the other practical concern that I have with extending that principle at all is that this court has never given any indication of how anyone is supposed to objectively determine whether or not something is a matter of great public concern. On a number of instances, the court has said something is. In other instances, it has said it is not. And without any sort of objective factors to determine whether or not it is, I don't believe the court here should extend that exception to something that at least isn't a constitutional issue.
What is or isn't the matter of great public concern that's at issue here in your view?
Well, appellants have characterized it differently. Today it sounds like the matter of great public concern that they're asserting is their ability to participate in the process. If that is true, I would assert that although that is a valuable aspect of the regulatory process, I don't believe that would rise to the matter of great public concern.
So that would be the process?
Today they claim it's a process challenge, yes, and so I don't believe the process challenge would rise to a matter of great public concern.
Does it pertain to the operation of government?
Loosely, almost anything under the APA could pertain to the operation of government. Again, here they've pled that it does relate to the citizens' ability to interact with their government, so it could be characterized that way. I think I would disagree, just because we're not talking about, again, as the court said in the Thompson case, we're not talking about abolishing the Public Service Commission or something that's fundamentally reworking government. This is a relatively minor interaction with your government. That's why, as I put in my brief, there's all of these other processes in place to address the regulatory system, via the legislature, via the attorney general, the secretary of state, the governor, the executive board. A senator can bring their own questions as part of this process. And so...
So that touches on separation of powers. The concern, is that right? The state's concern is if you have a problem with the process, it should be taken up in other branches?
Well, I think if you have a problem with the process and the regulation affects you, you can raise it this way.
So that's injecting the substance of it again?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So no further questions. We ask the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we
thank
have
you.
Time for rebuttal?
49
seconds. Mr. Litteran Kaufman.
Project Extra Mile was correctly decided, and overturning Project Extra Mile would require the court to overturn Chambers as well. Chambers was based on the Declaratory Judgment Act, and the language of the Declaratory Judgment Act is similar to 84911 in that it also purports to limit standing to those who were affected by the statute.
But doesn't Project Extra Mile say, isn't there a qualifier that essentially there's no one else to bring the suit? So a taxpayer could bring this?
That does exist in Project Extra Mile, although Project Extra Mile would appear to limit it to failures to assess and collect taxes rather than unlawful expenditures. But even if that requirement does apply, there is no better suited plaintiff here for the reasons that the court was discussing with my learned opposing counsel, that the prisoners on death row are very unlikely to be able to participate in the procedure and therefore to assert a procedural violation.
Could they have lawyers?
To the extent that they have lawyers and are working with lawyers, they might be able to, but there are a lot of hypotheticals built into that. And the ability